Hey, everybody, and welcome back to The Living Stone, a podcast from Greystone Baptist Church in Raleigh, North Carolina. Today, recording day, is June the 5th, 2020, which means it is 6 days after the death of George Floyd. Normally, we wouldn't start out a podcast recording by dating ourselves in space and time, but this is a moment in history that we feel is important to mark. And as Steve and I sit together to record the next episode of our study of Joan Chittister's book, Scarred by Struggle, Transformed by Hope, we both had to kind of pause a minute and recognize that on our schedule, today's conversation is set to be the struggle with fear and the gift of courage. And so I think in light of the series of protests across the country, a new awakening about racial injustice, and kind of sitting in the very hard spot, the uncomfortable spot between fear and courage, perhaps between calling and waiting for an answer to that calling, we're here. And so we're here today on June the 5th, and we're going to be talking about fear and courage. And we're so glad that you've joined us for this conversation.
You know, and we can't avoid talking about what's happened this past week, Chrissy. There's been so much going on. Even as yesterday, we had one of the memorial services for George Floyd, one of three, I think. And we've seen the worst of things that we've seen and the best of things. We've seen peaceful demonstrations. We've seen rioting and other things. And so there's a lot of fear going around because we're still dealing with COVID-19 pandemic and all the issues associated with that. So in such a time, there's a lot of emotion. Good judgment can become clouded, truth obscured. Many of us are locking down, becoming defensive, and kind of reverting to our old ways of behaving in times like this. I think it's useful to point out what Joan Chittister says about fear, and it seems to apply to this as well. Fear cripples us more than any disease ever could. It takes eminent good sense and turns it into gelatin, or it takes utter sincerity and turns it into simpering sycophancy. Fear tempts us to sell our souls in exchange for the grossly lesser prize of false security. We see it as security because it buys us time, but it is false because those who refuse to honor our questions will refuse to honor our person anytime it suits their needs. I think this touches on some of the injustices that we're dealing with and the change that's being thrust upon us and changes. It's kind of like a tidal wave, a tsunami of things that have happened and this emotional swirl of what we're being caught up in this country. And so people are naturally afraid and want to retreat. The people that want to get over with, get back to normal, it's just not happening at the rate people would like to see it. Mm. So we've seen some great acts of some terrible acts of human behavior, and we've also seen some wonderful acts of compassion on all sides of this struggle. I wanted to recall some things about my experience as a kid back when I was in between the 8th and 9th grade back in 1968. I do remember that there were other times in our history, of which I was alive during that time, that were also turbulent. The 60s are very turbulent in terms of the civil rights demonstrations. And then in 1968, when we had the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King in April of that year, we had riots in 110 cities around the country. There were not just peaceful demonstrations, but there was actually rioting. So that stirred up a lot of emotion there. We also had the assassination of Robert Kennedy in June of that year, I believe. And then we had a Democratic convention in Chicago, which turned kind of ugly with demonstrations about the Vietnam War. So at that time, we didn't just have civil rights issues and injustices being protested. We had a very unpopular war going on at the time. So people were very vocal. They were in the streets by the thousands, tens of thousands, in many places. So it's not unlike what's happening now. I remember a phrase from that time. The whole world is watching was one of the chants of the demonstrators in Chicago. And it was a mantra, and they were talking about Mayor Daley at the time cracking down on protesters, and right outside the Democratic convention, it was kind of an ugly appearance of things. So, anyway, these things are in the public perception. Many of us are picking a side. Some of us are trying to be neutral as we possibly can, but it is an immense struggle that we're going through right now.
Yeah. I think there are a lot of resonances with what you're describing from 68 to 2020. It's funny, when we met to first plan this conversation, you know, earlier this week, I had woken up that morning thinking, wow, maybe this is what 1968 felt like. And then to come here and hear you kind of hit that same chord tells me that maybe we are kind of back in that place in history. I don't know, but there are some things that you said a moment ago that I want to lift up and put into kind of a spiritual framework. The quote that you read from page 46 of Chittister's book about fear crippling us, there's a line in there that says, "Fear tempts us to sell our souls in exchange for the grossly lesser prize of false security." And I think this is a spiritual problem. You know, I think about a lot of times people of good faith and good conscience get together and know what the right thing to do is, but we're too afraid to do it because it threatens our sense of security. And I think that individually, as people of faith, and together as a church seeking to be the body of Christ in the world, we have too often opted for security. We've made decisions based on budget, based on what makes logical sense, based on what will be marketable. And we have forgotten that we follow a Christ, we follow Jesus of Nazareth, who didn't opt for security, but opted for what was right over and over and over again. And we know where it led him. I mean, he died on a Roman cross. And so the question, I think, for us is, do we really take that call seriously to follow Jesus all the way to a cross, whether it's our cross or the cross of our neighbors? And so I think that is a spiritual problem where we especially white middle-class Christians, I know I'm not going to make any friends saying that, but we are so used to feeling secure and we want to feel safe. And that's usually a viable option for us. And so the idea that God might be calling us into a space that doesn't feel safe and secure is a new, spiritual calling for us. And it's one that's wrought with fear. And so I wonder if we might sit in that for a minute and think about what that looks like. I mean, if you take away all of the anti-racism kind of movements that are happening, and we don't even talk about that, if we just talk about the pandemic that we're in, of course there is a racial analysis of that describes how even the pandemic is affecting people of color more than middle-class white folk like you and I. But the fact that our churches have been closed for 12 or 13 weeks now is a really scary thing. It doesn't feel safe. It doesn't feel secure. It doesn't give me, it doesn't feel like a warm blanket kind of wrapped around my spiritual journey. It feels alone and it feels risky and it feels like I'm wandering through the desert without my community. And that is not a good feeling. It doesn't feel safe and secure. And then you add on to that this other piece about race. And when you start examining the history, you recognize that, you know, white Christian churches in the South have not been doing our work. We have not been trying to understand the history, trying to be honest about the systemic nature of racism, including in the systems of our churches, but really in every major system. And I think it's because we're afraid to talk about how those systems have been set up to benefit us, to make us feel safer, to make us more secure. We don't want to talk about the cost of that. And now is a moment in history where I think we have to choose the other path.
I wanted to go back to a couple things that she says in the chapter about the loss of certainty, because I think they kind of tie in. She talks about civil wars, human trafficking, child slavery, apartheid, displaced refugees, ethnic cleansing, falling of the Twin Towers on 9/11, which was probably not too long before this book was published. And so she didn't have in view the things that we're experiencing this year. But I know it's obvious that she lived at a time when the Holocaust was mm-hmm. around and some other times, because she's of that age, that generation. And certainly she would recall the things that happened in 68 that I reflected on a while ago. But here are a few quotes from that chapter, which I'll just read a few, and they kind of tie in also. As a species, as nations, as peoples, as persons, we were all capable of the unthinkable. We were doers of the undoable. We were all accessories to our own hubris. It's a reflection on, you know, sometimes we're complicit, either because of our passivity or our we're not saying anything, we're not taking a public stand about things, but we are complicit in some of these things that end up happening because we kind of allow that authority to take over, whatever, the civil authorities, the worldly authorities to take charge. Another comment, these are the issues that change our very understanding of ourselves, the very nature of our struggles. They change the shape of our lives. They change the fabric of our souls. They shake our certainties. They send us back upon ourselves for the unassailable direction the institutions were no longer able to give. Mm. This is kind of, people are questioning the institutions right now.
Yeah.
That kind of perpetuate the problems that we've had for a long time. And then one last thing from chapter two I'll read. The whole question becomes, what, if anything, is there inside us to carry us through this period of social and personal disorientation, of social and personal malaise, of personal and social relativism, not just to make the confusion bearable, but to vindicate the struggle? In other words, making the confusion bearable is just like a retreat to some kind of false sense of security, of normalcy, of the way things were, and let's just buy some time and figure this out. Let's kick the can down the road, but not deal with the real issues that are pressing upon us as a society.
Yeah.
And also to vindicate what we're going through. This is a terrible time of struggle for us. And so what is it that we're going to get out of it? What are we going to do? This is a huge question for everyone today, June 5th, 2020.
Yeah, it really is. And, you know, it reminds me that, again, I really will not make friends on this podcast today, but I think we have, as people with some, you know, limited with power in society, I mean, with financial resources, meager as they may be, they're there, with steady employment, with education, with support systems of family and friends and church, it's easy for us to say, let's kick the can down the road. And I'm reminded that that's not something that my friends who are people of color feel they can do. You know, shared an article that a pastor friend wrote about how every black boy gets the talk from their mom. And so whether or not, we're ready to say that, that police brutality is real and is happening, it is very real in communities where people of color fear for their lives every time they're pulled over, or every time they have to interact with law enforcement. So I'm not saying all police officers are bad. I'm not saying I'm anti-law enforcement, but what I am saying is there is a very real fear that is rooted in real history. And it creates a different reality for people of color than it does for people like me. Where I can sit back and say, you know, we're in the midst of a pandemic. Like, it's not really a great time to be protesting.
Mm-hmm.
But the truth is, there is a more serious and a more deadly pandemic that is happening, which is what people are protesting now. And yeah, that's uncomfortable. So I think that, you know, there are several lines in the chapter about fear that talk about how fear paralyzes us and kind of collaborates with these false senses of security to tell us the lie that we don't have to create change. Now's not the time for change. And yet the ability to say that and to really believe that and to sit there and and dig our heels in and say, no, it's not really the time for change. Is a place is us speaking from our place of privilege. She says on 47, oppressors do not get to be oppressors in a single sweep. They manage it because little by little we make them that. We overlook too much in the beginning and wonder why we lose control in the end. And, you know, there's so many prophetic quotes from Holocaust from, you know, the 1930s all the way up to 45, you know, where we talk about, well, why didn't you say something? You know, well, I didn't know. And it's like, no, you knew, you just chose that it wasn't the right moment. It wasn't quite bad enough yet. And so I feel like, again, we're in maybe even the last 10 to 12 years since Trayvon Martin, like we have been in a season as a society where instances of racism and death resulting from racism have been telling us there is a discrepancy here in the lived experience of people of color and, you know, white Americans. And too often I think we say, well, you know, that was an exception. That's not really the whole experience. Like, can we just not talk about that right now? And I think that is exactly how oppression, systemic and individual, is allowed to continue to fester. And so when I read this sentence on 47, I underline it, I highlight it, and I say, yeah, yes, we overlook too much in the beginning, and we're afraid to accept it because it means that everything that makes us feel safe has to change.
Right. I wanted to touch on, you mentioned this, we've given up too much of ourselves to an authority. In one of her videos that I watched, the quote is, passivity is the path to powerlessness and oppression, which kind of ties into that. Many of us are afraid to speak out. Mm-hmm. I think the recent days we've seen people powered or emboldened, say, to say things that they had not said before. And I'm talking about all sides of the issue and from all races and all ethnic groups.
Right.
People are speaking out, and you see not just black people participating in the demonstrations, but others, white people, Asians, every all kinds of people, because they feel a common bond in this, a common stake in this.
Right.
There's something before the quote that you read from page 47. I think even as kids or as people that are maybe still afraid and holding things back and not saying much. She says, we struggle with fear of criticism as we try to hide our inadequacies, even from ourselves. We struggle with the fear of ridicule remembered from grade school playgrounds and transferred from there to the playgrounds of life. We struggle with the fear of being different, maybe of standing out and of taking a stand. But one of the things that she clearly points to below on that same page, well, let me read this whole paragraph because I think it's all good. On a personal level, authorities free of accountability bind our souls. They keep us in servitude to a bogus notion of superiority. They claim a power to which they have no right and engage us in the collusion. Our fear of them is a measure of our own moral maturity or our lack of it. But moral maturity requires us to choose truth over self-preservation, whatever the cost. Mm-hmm. It faces us with the responsibility to choose new heights of conscience over personal comfort.
Yeah.
And that's what so many of these folks are doing.
That's right.
And they feel emboldened to do so.
One of the things, when you were reading that we struggle with fear of, you know, criticism or inadequacy or ridicule, I wanted her also to say we struggle with fear of being wrong and to being found out to have been wrong.
Right.
And, you know, I think that's what keeps so many people silent. Especially well-meaning white people who really care about creating a just and equal world, an equitable world for all people, regardless of color. And we don't know what to say. And we don't want to say something wrong. You know, that would be embarrassing. So we just don't say anything at all. And that is another layer to the thing at the bottom of the page about self-preservation. But I think, you know, her concept of moral maturity is one that we really need to hold on to. Because there was a time, and I think there is a time in the future, where grown, mature, responsible adults and people of faith can get together and say their truth and be in a place of difference with one another and be okay with that and also be in a place where they could sit around the room and say, oh, I hadn't thought about it that way. Man, I was wrong. You know, for example, when I opened this podcast today, I said that George Floyd was killed 6 days ago. It was actually 13 days ago. I was wrong. I had Memorial Day wrong. Like, I was flat wrong on that. I knew it felt like longer than 6 days.
Right.
But there are so many bigger things that we are wrong about. And I think that the whole world might be a better place if we could sit down and just own some of that and not worry so much about being wrong. I have a six-year-old. She's in first grade right now, and we're doing digital school like everybody else. And one thing I've noticed more than ever before when she was at school alone or with her classmates, but I wasn't her primary teacher, you know, is she's afraid to be wrong. She would rather not do the spelling test than get one word wrong. And that is a problem.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a problem because in a lot of ways, we don't learn until we recognize that we've got it wrong. You know? So I wonder what that looks like for grown adults with our spirituality.
Right.
You know?
Just on a personal note, I know that some friends of mine posted things on Facebook, and I have friends that span the political spectrum, everything from very liberal to very conservative. And so I'm always careful about responding to things on Facebook. But a friend of mine from some years ago, a musician friend, posted something yesterday that was somewhat encouraging. And he admitted that he was on the liberal side of things. And he had a long conversation with a friend, also a musician, that's on the very conservative side of things. And they had a long conversation. And one thing he did say was, we came together as friends. We had a long, very heartfelt discussion about things, and we disagreed on many, many things, but that we parted friends and we still love each other. He said maybe more than we did before because we understand and maybe respect something that we didn't before. And that's part of this change that Joan Chittister talks about throughout the book. Change, when it comes upon us, we respond, we can run and hide from it, or we could go through it and we are become out on the other side, a different person. Mm-hmm. So, and I know these kinds of conversations are happening, and I hope we feel like we don't have to be afraid of ridicule or confrontation. Confrontation doesn't have to be violent. It doesn't have to be ugly.
Right.
It can be peaceful. And sometimes it takes tremendous courage to have those kinds of conversations.
Yeah. I mean, I actually think that one of the gifts perhaps of COVID-19 and staying at home and social distancing may be that we do things on a smaller scale than we did before. I think it's very intimidating to go into a room of 50 people and have to disclose that you've been wrong about something your whole life, or that you believed the wrong news, you know, you believed the wrong narrative about some moment in our history. And now you're having to come to terms with the fact that you were wrong. And maybe even that you acted on that wrong thing. That can be very embarrassing. It can be very full of shame. It can make one feel very guilty. But I think, at least for Greystone, a church that has said for the last 5 years at least, that they want to have hard conversations. We want to talk about things that mean something, that matter, that speak to what we're seeing unfold in our world. But we haven't found a way to do that yet. And so I wonder if in this season where we're really just meeting with one or two people at a time and we're doing that outside on a porch or in the parking lot, I feel like these are really good opportunities for us to have conversations that are really hard to have on a broad scale, but to have one-on-one or in the company of 2 to 3 friends where you can say, you know, I could look at you, Steve, and say like, Steve, you know my character, or you know that I'm really trying to do the right thing here. And you also heard me say that really dumb thing that I said 10 minutes ago. Yeah, thanks for not judging my entire human person
right.
on that.
Yeah.
But help me process, you know, and we can do that difficult work in these small group settings. So I think that there may be some unique opportunities for us that emerge from this horrific layering of traumatic experiences that we're having right now.
I wonder if we might move on to the courage
portion
a little bit.
Let's do it.
Joan Chittister closes that chapter 10 about fear with this paragraph. Clearly, there is a gift that beckons in the struggle with fear. It is courage. Or as Friedrich Dürrenmatt wrote, this is the only art we have to master nowadays, to look at things without fear and to fearlessly do right. It is the call to courage that is the seedbed of hope. And that's going back to that moral maturity thing. Mm-hmm. It requires us to choose truth over self-preservation, over fear. And we're kind of put in a position where we have to do something. We can't just stay silent.
Yeah.
And one of the first, let's say bottom of page 49, I'll read this, the gift of courage, the chapter on gift of courage. It is when we are most afraid of something that we know that only courage is the correct response. Courage is the capacity to stand our ground, to speak the truth, even in the face of overwhelming odds.
Yeah.
And so, and then she goes on to say some other things about courage, that it's not so rare a quality as we sometimes like to think. We forgive ourselves the responsibility to muster it on the grounds that it is the unwanted virtue of unusual people in momentous circumstances. The truth is that courage is what carries simple people through an average day. It is not an action, it is an attitude. It is the spiritual strength that gives direction in the midst of confusion. It is no more uncommon than fear. It is, in fact, the child of fear, which I thought was kind of an interesting analogy.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, let's lean into that for a minute. I love what she says about how courage is not summoning like an abnormal amount of, you know, whatever to get through a monumentous or momentous, what did she say there? I don't remember the word. A major event, right? It's
right.
Not putting on your superhero costume and lifting up a car off of a person it's crushing. Like, that's not mm-hmm. courage. That's adrenaline. But mm-hmm. But I think courage more often shows up in our ability to do sometimes even self-examination. Like, sometimes it's not even speaking out and calling out an injustice that we see in the world. Sometimes it's an ability to sit back and say, whoa, I've got some personal work to do here. Like, it makes me feel uncomfortable when I hear that phrase tossed around. But yet everybody's tossing it around, so maybe I have some work to do and to mm-hmm. figure out what that is and what is it that stirs up within me. And in the book, Joan uses the biblical narrative of Jacob wrestling the stranger. And she, on this page, says, you know, that Jacob holds on to the stranger. That's courage, is holding on to the wrestling partner. That which is grabbing you and trying to break your hip, like holding mm-hmm. on to that, that's courage. And I love that because I think there are so many different ways to kind of turn the Jacob narrative where, you know, maybe Jacob is wrestling God, maybe Jacob is wrestling his own demons, maybe Jacob is wrestling his past and trying to emerge to his future, maybe Jacob is wrestling, you know, his privilege as a male living in the ancient Near East with, you know, multiple wives and concubines and like, you know, all these animals he's traveling with after he's stolen his brother's birthright. Don't get me started, but he's got a lot to wrestle. And so I wonder if my way of wrestling right now is not necessarily, you know, posting on social media everything that I think about what's happening right now. There are plenty of people doing that. But maybe it's me sitting back and saying, what am I hearing? Like, what is coming out of the voices, particularly of people of color who are in deep pain right now? What am I hearing from that? And what part of me resists that? Maybe I need to wrestle that part of me and figure out what, you know, what's going on there. So I think about the different moments of courage that I've seen in this pandemic. I don't even remember how many weeks. It's somewhere between 12 and 13 at this point, I think. But, you know, I've seen deacons in this church make 20 cold calls in a week's time. That's courage. You don't know what you're going to get when you call somebody you don't know, who may have been a member of your church for 20 years and you've never met them. And here you are, a deacon, and you're going to call them and say, hey, how's it going? You know, that takes guts. And I've seen courage. I've seen grown adult children care for their parents in their last days. That takes tremendous courage. I have seen families plan funerals that they never thought would happen the way that they're happening. That takes courage. I've seen young mothers have new children into this world. That takes courage. A couple got married outside last weekend in the midst of a pandemic. That takes courage. What does it mean to try to start something new and hopeful in 2020? You know,
right.
It's either crazy or it's courage, but it's happening.
And it's different for everybody. One of the things that she says, it's on page 51, those that are following along in their books, it's middle of the page. Courage also implies our willingness to be honest with ourselves as well as with others. It requires that we learn to accept our limitations and to live within our boundaries. It recognizes, in other words, she recognizes your cultural limitations, where you came from, what kind of life, who you move in the midst of, what your circumstances are, and a lot of other things. But everybody has the opportunity to act with courage at some point, whatever they're facing in their lives. Mm-hmm. And she goes on to say, just below that, courage is not the lost part of ourselves. It is the hidden part of ourselves that only fear can energize. Fear is not the opposite of courage. Fear is the catalyst of courage. So These circumstances, these things that develop, bring things out that we didn't even know would happen as our response to those things that are happening to change.
Yeah. There's a old Vacation Bible School curriculum. I think it's about Joshua. Be bold and courageous. I think that may have been a Bible drill memory verse mm-hmm. also. Mm-hmm. There's like a kitschy song about it. But this holding up Joan's words with our current context, and then remembering those things that we were taught as children, like songs of the faith, scripture from our Bible, stories of the faith, be bold and courageous, be strong and courageous. I don't remember a passage in the Bible where a prophet is saying, no, go hide and rest a little while. This will work itself out. You know, the call is constantly, I know you're afraid, but do not fear. You know, have courage, because God is with you and God will continue to be with you. And within that, there is not a promise of safety ever.
Right.
You know, sometimes you make it to the promised land and sometimes you don't, but your ancestors do. And so I think for us, it's important to claim courage personally, but also to claim courage collectively and recognize that our story is an end and it's not about us. It's about the global impact of our actions as we are a small part of Christ's body in the world. So how are we moving that hand collectively a little more towards justice for all people, a little more towards courage?
Hey, everyone. Unfortunately, due to technical difficulties, this recording has been cut short. Please check back soon for the remaining episodes in this podcast series.